I'm on. I think I'm on. Yeah, I'm on. And in the spirit of full transparency, I didn't ask to do this. He asked me to do this, all right? So, and I'm honored that he did, but I don't for one second think that I've got all the answers. In fact, I don't even know all the questions. And I'm being super humble. I'm being honest. Missions is an amazing endeavor. But as I said last night, I grew up in it, and I've seen a little bit. And what I wanted to do was give you all a chance at some point here in the middle bit to maybe, if you've got questions, I may not have the answer, okay? But if you've got questions or you've got a scenario or situation you want to throw at me, you're welcome to do that, all right? I'm not trying to keep it informal. When it comes to missions, obviously you know this. It's the work of God. It's God's work, and we're all thrilled and humbled to be a part of it. But there's a lot of unique challenges that we face in missions, and I was thinking as I was looking around at the missionaries that are here. We got the brother going to the prisons, so that's a completely different set of dynamics he's going to deal with than the brother in Africa,
right.
Who, by the way, was on the mission field from the time he was 16 till the time he, you know, left to go back to the States. So he's been there, seen it. His parents are there, second generation. So he's got a whole foundation to build on. Then we got a brother here that's a pastor. He's got ministry experience going to a very difficult place in Europe. So every single one of these dynamics right here are going to pose a whole different set of problems and challenges. A lot of them will be similar, but many of them will be unique to where you are. And so I don't for one second want to, you're recording this, right? Okay. But I don't want to one second, assume that blanket statements covers all the bases. That's why I said, if you've got questions or, you know, if you've given so much thought to where you're at or what's going on, whether it's deputation or the mission field, and you want to throw something at me, we'll hash it out together with the understanding that I don't know it all. Again, I don't know it all, and I don't think I know it all. I had the opportunity about 2 weeks ago down in Brother Joel Haynes' church, his Bible college down in Arlington. He had asked me to come down there and do a missions kind of crash course, a module in their Bible college. And so I did most of a day, just 1 hour after another. And God gave you a bunch of new stuff, fresh stuff, about missions that I've got with me to draw from if we need it this morning. About the book on deputation, that was the first book I ever wrote. And that came about because, as I mentioned last night, God helped us. God did it. It wasn't me, but God helped us. We raised our support in 10 months. And that's unheard of. I know that. I knew it then. But I watched God do something amazing. Interestingly enough, we were at the Rock of Ages prison revival down in Parchment, Mississippi. And the dear man of God, his name's slipping my mind, Ron Garris, my wife and I have known him our whole life. This was before he died, obviously. He was moderating this meeting, which was made up of missionaries for Rock of Ages and pastors that had come to Parchment, Mississippi, and they'd come to this church every morning, like we're doing right now, have a little devotion and pray, and then we'd all go to the prison and take those little tote things, stuff them full of tracts and handkerchiefs and whatever, and literature, and go in there and spend most of the day talking to prisoners. And it was a maximum security prison. It was an amazing open door. It was a great experience. But we were in one of those morning sessions like we're at right now, and Brother Garris said, "Grace, I want you and Stacy come up here and tell everybody what God has just called y'all to do." This was literally, I had just got back from my survey trip. And I got up there, and of course, I was fired up. I'd spent about 10 days in Africa, man, and I knew that's where God wanted me. There wasn't no question. I came back, told Grace, "This is where we're going." I didn't have prayer cards, a display, slide presentation, a mission board. I didn't have anything. When we'd already scheduled to go to that prison revival. And so Grace and I got up there, and man, I was just bubbling. I was about to bust about Africa. And Brother Gary said, how many of y'all want to help them get to the field? And the pastors and Rock of Ages missionaries that was there started taking us on for support. $10 a month, $20 a month, $50 a month. And in about 20 minutes, we had $400 a month support pledged. Okay? And well, we were trying to raise $4,000. So here I got 10% of my support, and I hadn't even got started yet, thanks to Brother Garris and that meeting. And so it was like a momentum that shifted. And as I was calling pastors, they always ask you, you know, how long have you been on deputation? I've been on deputation 2 months, 3 months. How much support you got? I got 30% of my support. They're like, what? I'm like, yeah, God's helping us get there. And that just kind of kick-started it. And not to mention that I knew a lot of pastors because I had been a missionary's kid. And so we had a lot of things that was going for us. And I'm saying all that because at the end of our deputation, I started getting inundated with phone calls from missionaries saying, man, how did you get your support up? What am I doing wrong? I've been on deputation 3 years. I've been on deputation 4 years. And I noticed, as y'all do, when you go to all these missions conferences and you interact with other missionaries, you see why some of these people are not getting their support. Here's the problem. Nobody tells them. Nobody's going to pull that missionary off to the side and say, sir, nobody's going to support you. Your wife is rude. She's got a bad attitude. And it might just be that one service or that might be everywhere. But nobody's going to pull them off to the side and say, it's your kids. Your presentation's boring. Your slides are too long. Whatever. And their pastor's not there to see it, so he can't fix it. So they keep making the same mistakes at every single church they go to. And so that book deals with just a lot of things to do and not do. And so that was the first book I ever wrote. And it was actually just an e-book for 20 years before I ever got it published. Incidentally, my son-in-law was the first person to buy it once I got it published, and he's in the Philippines. But they raised their support in a year and a half. To go to the Philippines. And so it just deals with a lot of things, just practical stuff. But you really, y'all know this, you get one strike and you're out. Unfortunately, you go to a church and pastors and churches are not all as missions hearted as this one will be. And you'll go to some of them and you can do no wrong. And you'll go to some of them and they want you to walk on water and then turn it into wine. All right. And it's unreal. It's unreal the hoops that some of them make you jump through. And you're there and you're at their mercy and you're just trying to get the feel. You've been driving for hours. Your kids come in. They're tired. You're tired, but you got to be on your best behavior. Everything's got to be perfect. And unfortunately, one of these days, the Lord will probably let me write a book. I've been wanting to do it for years. It's going to be a book that's one book. When you flip it over, the back cover will be the front cover and be two books in one. And the one book's going to be what pastors wish missionaries knew about pastors. And the other side's going to be things missionaries wish pastors knew about missionaries. And give it from both sides. Because a lot of missionaries go to churches and they act entitled. You know, I'm a missionary. I got a prayer card. Y'all ought to take me on. Not realizing this pastor might be on the verge of a split. Yeah. Or he might have just had a split. Right. You come in at the worst time. He didn't want to cancel you because you was booked, but he really don't want you there. And just having that discernment, that perception. There's a lot of things missionaries don't know about pastors, and there's a lot of things pastors don't know about missionaries. And I've seen both sides. You know, I was in a pastor's home. We saw missionaries come in. Then we went on deputation, was a missionary. Then I went to the mission field with my family, and now I'm a pastor. I've seen it from every side. Now I got kids and grandkids on the field. I'm about as 3D and 4D as you can get, and I still don't know it all. But it's amazing how much there is to learn about missions. And so I didn't come in here this morning assuming to teach you anything. I want to encourage you. I want to challenge you to do all that God's called you to do. Here's what I'm going to do. I've got three different lectures, and I'm going to let y'all pick which one y'all want to hear. How's that? Because I like all three of them. But the first one is the portrait of a missionary, where it takes all the mysticism and all the hype out of it and just gets right down to brass tacks. This is what the life of a missionary really is. So that was lecture one, the portrait of a missionary. And then the second one is the partnerships of a missionary. And the third one is the planning of a missionary. Does anybody have a particular preference of which one you'd rather me deal with this morning?
I'd probably choose planning.
Planning? All right, let's do it. All right, that was easy. I mean, I love all three of them. The issue of the portrait of a missionary, I'll tell you what I'll do if y'all want me to. I'll give you my notes on that. Yeah, and obviously it's just vague notes. I could spend an hour on each one of these lectures, and I did in Texas just a couple weeks ago. The Lord gave me all this stuff sitting at the airport, and it was just amazing how the Lord even opened my eyes to some things I wished I had seen before. But the planning aspect is what we're going to talk about, and I had a funny feeling that's where y'all was going to go with that. And here's why. Bible college can't prepare you for the mission field. I don't care which Bible college you go to. I don't care if you major in missions. It's a good foundation, but it's not even close. My son-in-law graduated from a very well-known Bible college with a bachelor's degree in missions. And I told him, I said, if you would come work with me for a year, I'd be a lot more excited about you going to the field. Because I know what you don't know. You don't know what you don't know. Yeah. And there's some things you can't learn in the classroom.
Right. Sure.
And I'm not throwing off on colleges. It's just real. You can't learn to build a deck in the classroom. The only way I can show you how to build a deck is you put your nail apron on and help me build a deck. And I'll walk you through it and you can see it, learn how to run a saw and nail gun. And that's how you build a deck. You can't watch it on a video and learn how to. You can learn stuff, but you learn it doing it. So I don't care how much you prepare until you get to the field, your field, where God's called you. That's when you start learning how to do it. And so having that mindset, and I know this because I grew up on the mission field. I went to Bible college. I knew my Bible. And I went to Africa, and I felt like God had thrown me off in the deep end of the pool. I was like, what in the world? How do I not know this? I grew up in this. I watched Daddy do it twice. I helped Daddy do it in Samoa and Hawaii. Build a church from scratch. Which, by the way, starting a church from scratch in a foreign country is the hardest thing there is to do, other than maybe translating the scriptures from another language. That's probably, and I don't have the brains for that. But other than translating scripture, and I think about these people that go and they have to develop an alphabet and all that. That's way beyond my skill set. But other than that, starting a church from scratch, going into a city and starting a church from scratch, a New Testament, biblical, fundamental, independent, indigenous, self-supporting, self-governing church from scratch is the hardest thing a human being can do in the ministry. Hands down. It don't get no more challenging. I mean, every possible thing that can go wrong will go wrong. And understanding going into that whatever you know going into it, it ain't nowhere near enough. One of the men asked me in Bible college Tuesday night at our Bible college, Sherwood Baptist College. He said, "Preacher, what does it mean, add to your faith virtue and your virtue knowledge?" He said, "What does that mean?" I said, "It means that as long as you're alive, you're going to have to keep adding and growing in every one of those areas.
Right. Yes.
You never get to the place to where you plateau." I've got more questions now than I've ever had. I've been preaching since 1993. I've been saved since I was four. I'll be saved 50 years this year. I've got more questions now. I've got a greater desire to learn more and know more. I ask more questions, read more books now than I ever have. And I write books, and people ask me questions. More pastors call me for counsel than my church members do. And I tell my church that. I said, I've had more pastors call me this week for advice than all of y'all put together. Why? Because we get to a certain age in the ministry to where we realize I need some help. There ain't no sense in me trying to reinvent the wheel, as you said. I'm going to call somebody that maybe can help me shortcut this thing. So when it comes to missions and planning for the mission field, it's a spiritual work. It's not an accidental work, meaning God never intended his servants to approach the fulfilling of the Great Commission without thought, without structure, and without preparation. And again, preparation, you can never have enough. My son-in-law came on staff to intern with me for a year. He knew God was going to send him to the Philippines before he went to college. God called him to the Philippines in high school. My daughter started dating him in freshman year of college. And she knew that he was going to go to the Philippines. That's where he was going. And so I took her to the Philippines on a trip, just me and her. I said, "I want you to see the Philippines because this is where you're going to be. I want you to see it." And we went over together. And We fell in love with the place. The people are amazing. It's an amazing mission field. You can preach in English, which is awesome. You don't have to use a translator. And I've used hundreds and hundreds of times, but it's fun. It's better when you don't have to. But it was just an amazing mission field and sweet people. And that was me saying, this is where you're going to be. You better make sure this is who you want to marry, because this is where you're going to be. And that's where she's at now. And, of course, she's homesick. And we talk on the phone, FaceTime nearly every day. But I took her there. I said, I want you to know what you're getting into. Missions, a lot of times, we see the flags and we see we have the international dinners. And it's just this exotic, mythical, awesome, mission field. Until you get there, you buy a one-way ticket. And after about 2 weeks, the I'm a tourist feeling dissolves, and you realize I'm here. Yeah. I live here. I'm stuck here. This is where I'm going to be. This is where I'm going to raise my kids. The reality sets in, and if you haven't thought about it and prepared for it, it'll hit you hard. Spiritual zeal without planning leads to frustration, burnout, and failure. Mm. You can have all the zeal you want. You can be as excited about God's call on your life. I'm so excited God's called us. We're so thrilled to be going there. But if you don't plan for when you get there, it's going to be one brick wall after the other. You can alleviate a lot of that by walking through those scenarios and preparing for different scenarios. Biblical missions requires clear thinking, deliberate preparation, realistic planning. That's the other thing, realistic planning. I'm amazed at how many people do not allow themselves to be real in their preparation. Yeah. Good. You know, it's a big, beautiful idea. Africa. Oh, man. Africa. Oh, wow. Yeah, Africa stinks. It's dirty. There's diseases. Yeah. It's nasty. There's dirt everywhere. There's mud everywhere. There's poor people everywhere. You're not sitting at the house watching a National Geographic of a safari. You're living in many times it's an armpit of a place. If you don't have a heart and a mind prepared for what you're going to deal with when you get there, it's overwhelming. You're like, this is not what I thought it was going to be yet, because you weren't being realistic. Now, this brother's been there. He lived there. So I'm just saying, it's so easy to have this fantasy in your mind. And it's not real at all. It's not real at all. You have to plan realistically. And you have to be grounded, and you got to be mature about this. And survey trips, obviously, are priceless. Knowing where you're going, just knowing which city you're going to, trying to have some contacts and figure out stuff like rent. I'm shocked how many people raise support to go to a field. They don't even know what it costs to live there. Just their mission board throws a number out, so that's what they try to raise. And sometimes it's too much, and sometimes it ain't nowhere near enough. It's like, what are we doing? Do your homework. You know, this is 2026. Go over there. Talk to people. Look at the price of real estate and renting and groceries and what a car is going to cost you and that kind of stuff. A lot of missionaries get in the field and crash and burn because they don't have no support. They're just trying to make ends meet. And the whole time they're there, they're just sucking wind financially, struggling. Can't pay bills, and the wife's stressed out just trying to buy groceries. That could, you can alleviate all that just by raising enough support. It's amazing how many missionaries are like, well, I'm just going to step out by faith. No, that's stupid. It's stupid to go to another country undersupported. Now, if God tells you to do it, do it. But I'm just saying that's something that you can remove. You can get that all that stress off the table. Up front, just make sure you plan, prepare, know where you're going. Let's talk about a clear mission objective. A clear mission objective. Every one of y'all guys have got a mission objective. And the brother with the prison ministry is obviously going to be a different objective than those of you that are going to go somewhere and start a church. But you still have to have a very clear mission objective. And I have missionaries come to our church all the time. These young guys come in. And I'm like, what are you going to do when you get there? Well, we're going to start churches. Plural. Okay. It's a little much. We're going to go, we're going to start churches. Do you have any idea how long it takes to start one? And it sounds good. It looks good on a prayer card, but that's a lifetime. It's a lifetime commitment. I was just with a missionary Tuesday night. He's going to be in our missions conference next week. He has been in Liberia 10 years. They just started their first church, 10 years. They just ordained a preacher that they've been training for years. They just constituted their first church, 10 years. And you think, well, man, that's a long time. You're dealing with Africans, generational darkness. You're dealing with every single family is dysfunctional. You will not hardly find a saved husband, a saved wife, and saved kids that are faithful to each other, faithful to God, and serious about God. It's 1 in 10 million. To find a man that will stay with you 5 years to be trained for the ministry is rare. So for them to have been there 10 years, he was so excited. He said, we just started our first church. And now obviously they'll get some momentum. The guys that graduate from their Bible college, well, now they'll be able to go out and start more. You'll start seeing some exponential growth. My point is, have a clear mission objective. Church planting is the result of disciple making. That's not the starting point. There's a lot of people saying, I'm going to go start a church. And I look at them and I say, what does that look like to you? What does that mean? Well, I'm going to go and we're going to start a church. Like, that's, you got to get people saved first. Yep. Then you got to get them discipled. And then when you get a nucleus of them, then you can start a church. So you're talking to me about 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 steps down the road. What is your clear mission objective? It starts with the individual contact, getting people saved, one person saved, getting 2 people saved, getting 3 people saved, doing some aggressive discipleship and getting them. Yeah. So you have to, it's like the old analogy. How do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. How do you start a church? Leading one person at a time to the Lord and getting them discipled. Then you start the church. A lot of people just go overseas, they look for a building, put a sign up, and start inviting people. Well, that's one way to do it. And a lot of people have done it that way. But that's the hard way. It's kind of reverse engineering it. It's easier if you have some people. Do it at your house, around your table. When we went to Samoa in 83. I was 11. And we moved into the village of Pongo Pongo there on that island, 17 miles long, middle of the Pacific Ocean, in some places a quarter of a mile wide. I'm talking about a little speck on the map. And you land and you're there. It takes 4 months to get a package from the States in 83. Nobody called us on the phone because it was $4 a minute. So we were there. You're there. And you're white. And they're all brown. And it's an American territory, but they let you know you're a Palangi. You're a white person. Palangi. And it's rained every day. Rained every day. Hot every day. If you couldn't wear socks and shoes, your feet would get athlete's foot. You had to wear flip-flops. You had to. You couldn't wear socks and shoes there. It was just too humid. And just culture shock, man. Holy moly. But we went to the laundromat. We had been there about 2 weeks. We were at the laundromat doing laundry. And 5 Samoan men in their 20s walked in. For some unknown reason, to this day, I don't know why. They walked in. They sat on a bench. It's like that right there up against the wall. They didn't do laundry. They just walked in there and sat down. And me, being the zealous little missionary's kid, I go over and start witnessing to them. Well, 4 of them laughed at me and got up and walked out, but one of them stayed. And I talked to him for about 30 or 40 minutes, and my parents came over and kind of pulled the net, but I mean, I led him to the Lord. His name was Billy Robertson. He got up and left, and we didn't see him for a few weeks, and then he showed up at our house one night. He had gone to the other island for a visit and came back and looked us up. He walked in the house, sat down at the table, you know, what I need to know. He was hungry. So Daddy started teaching him. The next night he brings He brings Uyato. You could hear them walking down the street. You could hear their flip-flops on the... Whew. He brings Uyato. He says, tell Uyato what you told me. Uyato got saved. A couple nights later, here comes Ma'a and Uyato bringing Lameki. Lameki brings Ma'a. Next thing you know, there's about 7 or 8, 9, 10 Samoan men around our dining room table, 2 or 3 nights a week. And that's how we started the church. And Vili's cousin, Lingifo Yeti, he had an afro out to here. He worked at an auto parts place. He got saved. And him and his wife, Eileen, got saved. Their little boy, Francis. And God called Lingi to preach, and Daddy discipled and trained Lingi for 2 years. He became the pastor. And when we left that church, we had a pastor. And nearly everybody in there came from Vili. And it was just one leading one, discipling one at the time. And then you had a nucleus. And as Daddy is discipling them, he's talking about the church and importance of the church. And finally, one day, they looked at him and said, we don't have a church. We need a church. Why don't we have a church? This is in the discipleship. Daddy never said to them, we came over here to start a church. They're like, we need a church. Yeah, we need a church. Well, how can we have a church? Well, it's a good question. That's how we did it in Samoa. Right. Now, again, a lot of people go somewhere and immediately they rent a building. They've already got their home rent, their house rent, and all their power bills and water bills for their house. Now they got to rent a building. They got another whole set of utilities right off the bat with no people. Yeah. And they're inviting people to come into an empty building with nobody, and it's discouraging. It's easier to start it in your house and let it organically become a church. That's what Nathan and Marissa have done in the Philippines. You know, they're living in... I told him, he said, when he went back over there, and I said, he said, what should I do? I said, rent a house to live in that's big enough to have church in. That's got a big enough open area. And I said, don't worry about what it costs. It's still going to be cheaper than two places. And that's what they've been doing now for 3 years. They have been having church in their house. Good. Filipinos don't care. Most people don't care. It ain't got to be a nice building with a steeple. Now, if they get to that point, that's fine. But that ain't what they got to have to start with. I mean, last night they were all in Cornelius' house and got saved. Yeah, at some point, you're going to outgrow that house. Now we got to find something. But all I'm saying is, these are clear mission objectives. Breaking the work into small, achievable steps is biblical and it's wise. Jesus said, upon this rock I will build my church. He didn't build a building. He built people. Okay, the Great Commission, and you know this, is not just winning souls, but to teach them and train them. Getting them saved is the easy part. And it's not easy if you believe in repentance. It's easy if you just take my hand, close your eyes, repeat after me, and now you're saved. It's real easy. But we're talking about getting people truly saved. That's what Marissa Nathan's dealing with in the Philippines. You can go to the Philippines right now. You can do it anywhere. You can do it in the prison. You can do it in Africa. They'll do anything to please a white man. You can get 10 young people standing in a circle, witness to them for 5 minutes, quote the Romans Road to them, bow your head, close your eyes, repeat after me, and all of them will do it. But they didn't get saved. I mean, they just didn't get saved. They don't even understand. They don't even know what they're doing. Okay? Getting them saved, when I say getting them saved is the easy part. What I mean is that's the easy part. Getting them baptized is the easy part. The teaching them to observe all things, that is the work. Because he didn't just say teach them all things. He said teach them to observe all things. So don't just tell them what it says. Stay on them until they start doing it. Yeah. Good. Well, I never heard anybody explain the Great Commission that way. But teaching them to observe all things is not making sure you preach the whole counsel of God. And obviously you do. Teach them to observe all things means you teach them to do it. And that's a lifetime of work. But the clear mission objective, you got to know what you're getting into before you get over there. Or you're going to get discouraged. If you already know up front, this is what I've got to do, you're not going to get discouraged because you know it's going to take a while. You're already mentally prepared for that. Don't let other people's prayer letters mess you up. Because you got guys in some places that got big numbers coming in. And you got places where if you get one saved a month, you're tearing it up.
Yeah.
I mean, Europe is hard.
Yeah.
It's just, they're hard. And it is what it is. So a clear mission objective. And then secondly, disciple making, not just soul winning. And a lot of missionaries misunderstand the Great Commission by equating success with numbers rather than maturity and spiritual growth. We literally just dropped a missionary down in Central America. His prayer letter was mind-boggling. Last year, this is a year summary. Last year, we had 2,570-something people saved. We baptized 3. We dropped him.
Wow.
He's doing it wrong.
Yes, sir.
I don't care how you slice it. I don't care. We can talk about this till we're blue in the face. When it's all said and done, he's doing it wrong.
Right.
All right. And we just wrote him a sweet email, so that's not our philosophy. You know, and I'm thinking if you've only had 3 baptized out of 2,700 professions, how many of those 3 are you discipling?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I mean, he's running 40, but he's having thousands and thousands saved every year. That don't impress me.
Right.
Because I can do that. Anybody in here can do that. You can do that. You take me to the projects right now, and I can do that. I can get 25 professions before lunch. I know how to do that, but that's not the right way. That's not regeneration. That's not biblical evangelism. And I don't care what nobody says. And these people that do that, they're sending people to hell. They're making them twofold more the child of hell. All right, these people, and they think they're saved. Now that you'll never get them saved because they can remember the day you prayed with them, but they don't even know what they did. So disciples making is the objective, not just soul winning. So don't equate success with numbers rather than maturity and spiritual growth. Jesus worked for 3.5 years. Jesus Christ, God in the flesh, worked for 3.5 years and had 120 names in the upper room in Acts 1. 120 names. That's what it says, names, not people, names. He was on a church roll. 120 people. He fed 5,000 people. He fed 4,000 people. He healed how many people? How many people's kids did he cast devils out of? How many people did he touch and help and minister to and serve? And in John chapter 6, verse 66, and from that day many walked away from him. And he looked at the 12 that was left. He said, will you also go away? Like, we can start all over if y'all want to. I will start from scratch if I have to. Are you in or not? That's not a popular ministry philosophy, but he had 120 names in Acts 1 at the ascension. So disciple making is the objective. Being a soul winner is not the main qualification. Making disciples is the biblical mandate. Jesus said, if you don't take up your cross and follow me, you cannot be my disciple. So if you've got people that have made a profession of faith, but they're not willing to follow the Lord and believers' baptism, they don't want to come to church, they don't want to get involved in church, you've got nothing. You can put those numbers in your prayer letter if you want to make you feel good, but you know down deep inside, we're not getting anywhere. So getting people discipled is what you're supposed to do. Churches are built on trained believers. Trained believers. That's what you build churches with. Not just momentary decisions. And you cannot shortcut discipleship and expect lasting churches. Let me show you something that God just showed me just the other day. And it blew my mind that I have never seen this before. In Acts chapter number 11, you got the story here where all these people was getting saved at Antioch. This is Acts chapter number 11. You got to see this. Acts chapter number 11, people were getting saved. A great number believed, verse 21, turned to the Lord. The tidings of these things came to the ears of the church was at Jerusalem, and they sent forth Barnabas that he should go as far as Antioch, who when he came and had seen the grace of God was glad. He exhorted them all that with purpose of heart they should cleave unto the Lord. For he was a good man full of the Holy Ghost and the faith, and much people was added into the church. Verse 24. Okay, so the people was getting saved. A lot of people got saved. And the news of this reached Jerusalem. That's about 2 weeks if you travel. So people, before internet, before social media, before phones, they're traveling 2 weeks away from Antioch, and the church in Jerusalem, people are still talking about what God did at Antioch. That's how awesome it was. The hand of God was upon them. So the church in Jerusalem sends Barnabas back to Antioch like you would send, like the major baseball leagues would send a scout to a high school team. This guy can pitch. This guy can pitch 100 mile an hour ball. And they're hearing all this buzz about this local guy that can hit home runs or whatever. So they send a scout to go see if it's legit. Well, the church in Jerusalem sends Barnabas back to Antioch to see if this is real. Is this real? We don't even know who the preachers were. It don't tell us who the preachers were in verse 19 and verse number 20. These guys were not supposed to be preaching, tongue in cheek. They were not supposed to be preaching. The people they were preaching to weren't supposed to be able to get saved. This is right after what I preached last night. But because of the persecution of Stephen in chapter 11, verse 19, they're scattering all over preaching the word, but none of the Jews only. Verse 20, and some of them were men of Cyprus and Cyrene. When they came to Antioch, speaking to the Grecians, preaching the Lord Jesus, they weren't supposed to preach to them. They didn't know they were. They probably didn't know about Cornelius. They're just preaching. And a bunch of guys that was not sent to preach is preaching, and a bunch of guys that's not supposed to get saved get saved. And the word gets back to Jerusalem. They're like, we got to go check this out. So they send Barnabas. Is this for real? Well, Barnabas gets there. And the Bible says when he saw the grace of God, he was glad. Yeah. All right, now check this out. So people's getting saved. Guess what he starts doing? Discipleship. Barnabas never went back home. Barnabas never went back to Jerusalem. He looks around. He's overwhelmed with all these people that need to be discipled. So he goes find Saul. He goes find Saul in verse 25, found him, brought him to Antioch. It came to pass a whole year. They assembled themselves with the church and taught much people. Disciples were called Christians first at Antioch. They weren't called Christians first at Jerusalem. They was called Christians first at Antioch. Because they was being discipled.
Right.
Now I'm going to tell you how discipled they were. I'm going to tell you how grounded they were. This is what I'm talking about right here. 3 to 4 years later, you get to Acts 13, verse 1.
Right.
And the church that Barnabas and Saul discipled became so strong that it became their sending church.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's right. Good.
It was their sending church. Yep. And I preached at a church planters conference just a few weeks ago for Brother Tyson down in Bowie. And I told his church planters, there was about a dozen in there, I said, your objective when you go to start a church, a lot of these guys are going to go start a church to pastor it, which is great. We need them all up through the Northeast. It was a Northeast region, and we need, Lord knows we need churches up through the Northeast region. I said, your objective should be to go in there and have such an aggressive, planned, I'm talking about curriculum, literature, a plan to disciple your new converts, that 4 years from now, that church would be strong enough to send you out to go somewhere and start another church. Because the Bible starts out chapter 13, verse 1. They were in the church that was at Antioch, certain prophets and teachers. Where did those teachers come from? I'd like to think they was homegrown.
Right. Yes, sir. Yeah.
And as they ministered to the Lord, he said, separate me, Barnabas and Saul, for the work whereunto I've called them. Barnabas never went back to Jerusalem. He was sent from the church of Jerusalem to Antioch to check on the work and the report, and ended up staying, discipling those people, and then a few years later, God sends him to the mission field out of that church.
Yeah.
So our objective with missions should be to train a church that is so grounded, so solid, that there's teachers and high caliber quality men in that church. And indigenous, obviously. You know, my parents, when they were missionaries in the early 80s, we were sent out of Maranatha, out of Natchez, Mississippi. Dr. James Crumpton, I don't know if y'all know him or not, prince of preachers. But he was death on indigenous churches. He was so death on it. He was totally against Americans sending any money overseas to help nationals build buildings. And there was a lot of validity to his point. It can ruin a lot of churches. But that's how hard he was on it. He said they can raise their own money and build their own building because it needs to be theirs. And I agree with him to some extent. And we do help missionaries overseas build buildings. But that's how dogmatic he was about being self-supporting, self-propagating, self-governing. That's the definition of indigenous. And so, but the only way that's going to happen, the only way you're going to have a church that's self-governing, self-supporting, self-propagating is you have got to have an aggressive, planned discipleship program. And I think a lot of missionaries are just all about getting people saved, get them saved, get them into the church, get them saved. If they don't, if you don't get your nucleus grounded, that thing, they're going to be going out the back door as fast as they're coming in the front door. And that takes a while. And that's why they don't do it, because it's hard. And it's not pretty. It don't look good. It don't look good in your prayer letter, you know, that you've got a small group. But the solid nucleus is what will start reproducing.
Right.
So, back in the West days, they used to build a herd. They'd get a bull, some cows, and they'd grow a herd. Take a while. They'd build a ranch. You start out small. After a while, you got a herd.
Yeah.
But then you got these guys that want to slip out in the middle of the night and go steal somebody else's and change the brand and grow their herd faster. Cattle rustlers.
Yeah.
Got a lot of that in the ministry.
Yes, sir.
Don't care what I got, as long as it looks good. Don't have to be legit. Don't have to be right. And so the discipleship is huge. Preparation before commission. Paul and Barnabas did not begin their ministry as church planters. They began as disciple makers. And Acts 13 is clear. Acts chapter 13, verse 2 is clear. As they ministered to the Lord. God sent Paul and Barnabas to go somewhere else and do what they were already doing in their local church. Got a change of location, a change of address is not going to change your heart, your burden, or your faithfulness.
Right.
If you're not already doing it in your local church, you're not going to do it halfway around the world.
Yeah.
A lot of guys are wanting to go to the mission field. I had a guy stand up in church one time. I was a pastor in South Carolina. Had a man stand up. He said, I mean, it's so unethical. It was so embarrassing. He said, I want church to pray for me, my wife. God wants us to go out west and help church planters build churches. I was young then, so I didn't say nothing. But if it was now, I would have said, brother, you can just go ahead and sit down because you don't even show up for soul winning here.
Yeah. Right.
You're not going to go out west and do nothing that you're not already doing here. Of course, he ended up not going. I mean, it was just an emotional reaction, and he didn't go because God wasn't in it. And I wouldn't let him go. I wouldn't even send him out of our church to go help a church planter out west. Do what? You gonna have him do what? Sit on a pew? You gonna sit on a pew? You gonna warm a chair? Because that's all he was doing at our church. And what I love about Paul and Barnabas is they were sent out to do in other places what they were already doing.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And so preparation before commission. And that's one reason why I told Nathan. I said, Nathan, my son-in-law, and he was so excited about going to the Philippines. But he told me, he said, I know, I don't know what I need to know. I said, you got a foundation, but you really need to learn a bunch of more stuff. I said, won't you come intern with me for a year? And my words to him, I said, I'll put some hair on your chest. So I said. I said, I will show you the ropes because you're going to get on the Philippines and think, what am I doing? Because I know. I've been there. And so I threw everything at him that I could. I mean, I put him and the rest of my daughter over the single Sunday school class. So he's teaching Sunday school, teaching Bible every day in the school for an hour. I put him coordinating all of our sports. We got four sports, girls basketball, boys basketball, girls volleyball, and boys soccer. He had to coordinate all the games and practices and the referees. And you think, well, what's that got to do with missions? It's planning. It's coordinating. It's logistics. It's communication. It's skills that you need. And I knew that. It's looking at a calendar and taking a big mess and making it fit and making it work. I put him over sports. I put him over all of our planning, our soul winning on Saturday, mapping all that out. I mean, making sure everybody knew where they were supposed to go. He was over the follow-up of all of our first-time visitors. And then on top of all that, we was doing construction. He was learning how to paint and hang drywall and lay brick. And at the end of that first year, he came to me and he said, Can I stay another year? Can I wait another year to start deputation? I said, why? He said, because I'm learning a lot. And so he interned with me 2 years. The first year was my idea. Second year was his idea. And then they went on deputation, raised their support in a year and a half, and now they're Philippines. And he told me just the other day, he said, you wasn't joking. I said, about what? He said, starting a church from scratch is the hardest thing in the world. I said, yeah. But those 2 years of interning with me, and he's discouraged right now. I'm not talking bad about him. He's discouraged because he would like to see more being done. If he hadn't been with me those 2 years, I don't know if he would have made it. I mean, because it's harder than you think it is. But he learned a lot. And all I'm saying is the preparation before you go is priceless. So Paul and Barnabas spent a whole year discipling those people. And then they were called Christians. But if you look at the time frame, it's about 3 to 4 years between Acts chapter number, those two chapters I just gave you. So Antioch was not just their sending church, it was a church they had built. They gained a lot of experience there, a lot of ministry experience. And they didn't set out to plant a church in Antioch. It happened organically. Did it not? It was organic. It was God doing it. But they did it the right way, and then it turned into a powerhouse. And so another thing I want you to know, talk about, every field is different. Not every mission field is equal in difficulty or complexity. I've already referred to that. And there's very little comparison between Italy and Zambia. Zambia, is that right? I mean, biblically, preaching, teaching, discipleship is going to be the same. Your approach and the way they receive it and the way they process it and the way you integrate it in their life is as different as night and day. Yeah. One of the crazy things about me being a missionary in South Africa, if you know anything about the culture of South Africa, you've got white South Africans, which are called Afrikaners. They spoke Afrikaans. It's a Dutch-based language. And then, of course, you had Africans. So I was a missionary to both groups. And it was like literally being a missionary to Kenya and Holland at the same time. You want to talk about dynamics? Oh, my soul. Because the white people spoke fluent English. They were all very well educated. And, of course, for years they'd had the heavy racism in South Africa, the apartheid. That was due to their Calvinism. Dutch Reformed. Calvinism. We're children of the covenant. They took all the rules and laws from Moses and they said, this is our land. This is our promised land. And all the black people, the Africans or the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Ammonites and the Jebusites, they stuck them off in little reservations and they ran South Africa until 1994 when America intervened and got Nelson Mandela out of prison. And then the black people could vote. For the first time in 1994, black people in Africa, Africans could vote. And so, obviously, they voted Nelson Mandela in overwhelmingly, and then the country now is run by Africans that have no idea what they're doing. They had not been trained, no education, nothing. And the corruption was out the roof. The infrastructure went down. They started, 94 is when Mandela came into office. We moved to South Africa in 2001, less than 10 years later. And the infrastructure was already starting to go. Power grids were going down, water, the railroad tracks, the highways, the phone lines, everything was going down because nobody knew what they were doing. And the white people got pushed out of all their jobs. And now they can't find a job. And the black people all run the jobs, but they don't know what they're doing. So they're just stealing all the money. It's insane. The economic and political dynamic that came into play when we were there and how it factored in. That's another thing I wanted to tell you. Where you're going, the politics, the economy, the history, all that's going to come in. Read every book you can on your history. Know what you're getting into. Why these people do what they do. They don't just do it because that's how they do it. They do it for a reason. If you can understand where they're coming from, it helps so much easier reaching them. And so I just did my research on South Africa, understood this is what hyper-Calvinism will produce. These people can't even get saved. They're almost like subhuman. One of the greatest days in my life as a missionary was when my white South African church members went out into the townships evangelizing with me. After believing for years that they didn't even believe in evangelism because they were Calvinists and they definitely didn't believe black people could get saved. And to have my Afrikaner church members walking up and down the townships with me, passing out John Romans in Sesotho and them weeping saying, I cannot believe this is the first time I've ever done this. And I'm like, yes! That was a huge victory. It was bigger than anything I'd ever seen in my life, the transformation that God can do and preaching can do. But what I'm saying is every field is going to be different. The challenges y'all face in Zambia and the challenges you face in Italy and the challenge, they're all totally different. All right, some fields are require more time to plan. Some's going to require deeper understanding. something's going to require involve multiple layers of resistance. You've got language, religion, history, worldview. You're going into the prisons. You're going to be dealing with these Hebrew Israelites, these black people, the Muslims. You're going to be dealing with homosexuality. You're going to be dealing with atheists. You're going to have guys that read their Bible all day, every day, that don't know God. It's crazy. But I mean, that's where God's called you, so God will equip you. But study the field, study the history of the country, study the predominant religions. You're going to need to brush up on Islam, because you're going to deal with a bunch of it. And I got a guy in my church, and him and his wife are fixing to start deputation. They're going to Israel. John Sasser was in Israel for years. His son Daniel Sasser is going back to Israel, but he's going to work with Arabs. He's going to go and work with Arabs and Muslims in Israel. There's millions of them over there. With big signs up, no Jews allowed. Jews are not allowed in Jericho. It's in the Holy Land. It's all Arabs. Arabic. The big sign. It's crazy. There's places in Israel that Jews can't go. We have never seen racism in America like you've seen over there. But he's going over there to work with Arabs, and he is right now studying Arabic. He's learning about Muslims. He's learning about Islam. He's learning about Muhammad. He's having to learn all that, because that's who he's going to be working with. Okay, so he's preparing already now before he even starts deputation. And I told him, I said, that's what you need to do. You need to learn everything you can. Learn the people. Learn how they think. Learn how they process information. Because if you're not careful, you'll just get ill. Why are these people 20 minutes late to everything? Why can't you be on time? Well, there's a lot of times it's because they had to wait on a taxi. A lot of times they had to walk. You know, we get in our car and we go somewhere. Our GPS says you'll be there in 7 minutes. We're there in 7 minutes. They're walking. So these are things that if you don't get this in your heart and your mind, you're going to have just culture shock all day, every day. You can help yourself by learning the people, how they think, how they process information, preconceived ideas about Americans. That's another thing, too. They're going to have preconceived Americans about ideas about you. Yeah. They're coming at you with walls up that you've got to break down. They're coming at you with stuff expecting you to say and do. And if you're not careful, you'll play right into that. So it works both ways. There's so much. You've got to adjust expectations without compromising truth. Paul said, I became all things to all men that I might win some. Meaning you do as much as you can to adapt without compromising biblical standards, of course. But, you know, you don't go to Africa and celebrate 4th of July and have the whole church have a cookout for 4th of July. That's our holiday. They don't get it. You'd be surprised that Americans are just like, I don't understand why these people don't celebrate Thanksgiving. It's like, you're an idiot. That's an American holiday. You ought to be having a big church cookout on their holiday,
right,
on a big day for them, you know. But that's that American mentality, bringing America over there. And so there's just, every field is different. Language, obviously, I don't know what your scenario is going to be like in Italy. I'm guessing most people in Italy speak English.
Depends on where you're at.
Yep. I would learn Italian. I would learn Italian, even if you don't have to preach in it. Just knowing it, interacting with them in the grocery stores, you'll build relationships. When I went to South Africa, they spoke English in South Africa. For the most part, most people did. It's on the signs, it's on the menus. They taught it in a school. It's a school. But you had a lot of older people that didn't speak English very well. A lot of the younger people didn't speak it as well. And the ones that did speak it, some of them weren't as comfortable because they talked to one another in their mother tongue. There was 11 official languages when we were in South Africa. 11. How many they got in Zambia? Multiple languages?
76 different tribal languages, but one national.
Okay, so there was 11 official languages in South Africa, which made it crazy. So, yeah, but depending on what region you were in, they spoke Sesotho or Setswana or Xhosa or Zulu or Ndebele, depending on where you're at, or Afrikaans. The common denominator was English. So I was able to preach in English. I still learn conversational Sesotho, and I learned conversational Afrikaans, because you win their heart when they hear you greeting them, interacting with them, even in your limited capacity. It meant so much to them. You didn't come in that I'm better than you because I'm an American. I don't have to learn your language mentality. We tell people, yeah, if you're going to come to America, learn English. Then we go to a foreign country and we don't learn their language. And so I never did have to preach in Sesotho or Afrikaans. I would throw words out a lot of times in my message. I'd throw words out for emphasis. Of course, they loved it when I did that. And if I was using a translator and I'm preaching in English, he's translating it in Sesotho. I start preaching in Sesotho, he'd translate it into English. I'm like, what are you doing? Because I'm translating. That's what I'm supposed to do. It was crazy. And I stand on the street corner and I'm talking to these old black African men and I'm talking to them in Sesotho. Do me lantati, lekantati. I'm not eating. And he's looking at me and he goes, I'm doing great, Pastor. I'm doing great. People walking by and this old man's talking English and I'm talking Sesotho. They're like, what is going on here? We're practicing our languages, man. But it wins their heart. It wins their heart. Eating their food. You know, you don't diss their culture and their food. My wife learned to cook their food and they people come over to our house. She cooked what they were used to eating. And we'd go to their house and we didn't turn nothing down and we learned to love it and we enjoyed it and there was no clash in the culture and food and that sort of thing. And it's little stuff that's annoying. You go to a restaurant and you order Coke and they give you a hot Coke in a can. You get chicken leg and a bowl of rice. This is a KFC. And you get a can Coke. It's hot. No ice, no cup, nothing. And you're like, I can't do this. Well, you do it. You drink hot Coke and burp all the way home. It is what it is. I mean, it's that or choke. I mean, you adapt. You can't say, hey, don't y'all serve ice in this place? They're going to look at you. No, they don't. You wanted a Coke? We got Coke. And that's what they got. And you learn to adapt. And it's just little things, every day, all day long. Of course, in South Africa, they drove on the wrong side of the road. Did they do it in Italy? What about Zambia? On the opposite side? So your steering wheel's on the opposite side of your car. You're driving a stick shift with your left hand. Yeah, buddy. It gets real quick. I'm talking about the day we landed at the airport in Johannesburg and we got in that Volkswagen Combi, that Jeep, that bus looking thing, and I'm driving through downtown Joburg traffic, roads everywhere. I'm driving on the wrong side of the road. I'm like, holy moly, it got real quick. Yeah, buddy. And I'd come home on furlough and drive down the wrong side of the road. I'd pull out of a church parking lot. I'm driving down the wrong side of the road. My wife's like, you're in the wrong lane. I'm like, but you adapt. You go through an intersection. You're like, all of a sudden you have a brain freeze. Like, I don't know which lane I'm supposed to take. It's crazy. But you adjust, you adapt, and it's so much better mentally than on your family as well. I got 4 minutes and we'll take a break. So I would really encourage you to learn the language, try to learn the language, at least on a conversational level if you can. The biggest thing is communication. You know, communication. My daughter, if you're listening to my daughter, she puts a lot of videos out on her Instagram reel. She talks to the children in the Filipino English. She sounds like them. She says the words like they say it. It's crazy. Because they understand her better. You're like, why would you do that? Because that's how they talk. And so she learned to talk English the way they talk English. So there's not a communication breakdown. What good is all the teaching and talking and witnessing if there's a communication breakdown? So learn to speak the way they do. Learn to communicate the way they do. Use phrases and leave out all the idioms and stuff that we're using in America. I have so many of them in the South. They don't translate well. You know, so, but then lastly, preparation before revival. Don't wait till you get there to make a list of what you needed to bring with you. You got the whole time you're on deputation to plan and prepare, whether it's get a container, park it at your house or somewhere and put stuff in there, literature, resource material, books, tracts, whatever, Bibles, scriptures, whatever you think you're going to need, take it with you. Because you're going to get there and you're going to realize you need it. And so we'll take a break. We'll come back and talk about that a little bit more. And then if y'all have got any questions or if you've got a particular topic you want to talk about, we'll talk about that for a few more minutes after the break. Is that okay, Pastor?
Yes, sir.